This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The UK's digital tech scene is accelerating, and the proof is in the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. This year, we celebrate the next generation of pioneering startups that are shaping the tech landscape of tomorrow. The UK is a thriving ecosystem with access to global talent, cutting-edge research, and unparalleled investment opportunities. Your big idea belongs here. Visit great.gov.uk/UKPA to learn more.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you again today. Great as always to have your company with us on the programme. Coming up today, why the price of checking the internet on your phone or making calls is about to be a lot more expensive in Nigeria. We're going to have the telecoms industry on the programme a little bit later on to try and explain why they feel the move is needed and why now. And we'll recap a terrible day for shares in one of the world's biggest wind turbine manufacturers, that's Ørsted. We'll be trying to get to the bottom as to why they've been one of the biggest individual fallers on global stocks and share markets today. All that to come here on World Business Report. If you want to get in touch with us about that story, or particularly if you're listening in Nigeria, where I know your internet's about to get a bit more expensive, but if you want to WhatsApp us, +44 330 678 3033 is the number. So that's +44 for the UK, 330 678 3033. We're going to kick off once again, though, with President Trump, because his first 24 hours in office have been busy ones with that slew of executive orders. Ryle Tandon and the team on business matters were talking through earlier on, and although not an executive order, this has also made the front of many of the world's financial news outlets.
We're thinking in terms of 25% on Mexico and Canada, because they're allowing vast numbers of people. Canada's a very bad abuser also. Vast numbers of people to come in, and fentanyl to come in.
When do you think you would enact
those? I think February 1st.
Are you planning on keeping notes of that?
I think we'll do it February 1st.
25% on both, sir?
On each.
Tariffs there. We talked a lot about them in the run-up, both to the US election itself and since President Trump's election win. The kind of opening salvo there, the opening position perhaps staked out by the now President Trump. 25% tariffs on each of all goods coming in from Mexico and Canada. Seems like the beginning of a negotiation, perhaps. What impact has that all had on financial markets today? Fiona Sincotta, Senior Market Analyst at City Index in London, is with us as always on a Tuesday. Fiona, great to have you back on the programme. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here. So much going on.
I know. Has it been a kind of hairy kind of couple of days on European markets? I know US markets just reopening again today after the inauguration. What have we seen? Any trends?
That's right. I mean, I think the big thing is volatility is what we saw yesterday at the end of the European close. There was that sort of optimism surrounding perhaps the fact that it didn't sound like universal trade tariffs were going to be brought in. But then we sort of had those comments later that actually there could be plans for those tariffs for Mexico and Canada. That sort of had an impact on those currencies. So we've seen some wild swings in the Canadian dollar. We've seen the US dollar, which fell yesterday, is rebounding today. Obviously, also oil markets. We've had comments from Trump about, increasing oil production in the US, which would increase oil supply to the market. So that's sort of seen oil prices fall a couple of percentages. Also, Bitcoin has obviously been on a wild ride, up to all-time highs and then fallen back later. And then the US markets, as you mentioned, they've just opened. But actually, the movement in the US markets is a little bit more muted. We're not seeing such a big big move as investors weigh up what's been going on so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Not the kind of rally that we saw perhaps in the immediate days after the election result itself either, was there? It does sort of speak to that kind of caution, the flip sides of some of these policies. One of those having to deal with the potential two sides of those policies and two sides of dealing with the new US president is, of course, the European Union. And we were talking to Faisal Islam, our economics editor, on the programme yesterday, live from Davos, in the same forum at the World Economic Forum. Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the EU's commission, said that they would take a pragmatic stance when it came to the new US administration.
A lot is at stake for both sides. So our first priority will be to engage early, discuss common interests, and be ready to negotiate. We will be pragmatic, but we will always stand by our principles. We will protect our interests and uphold our values, because that is the European way.
Ursula von der Leyen there speaking in Davos, Fiona. Is there opportunity for the European Union? In wider bits of that speech, she was talking about kind of Europe being now the kind of home of free trade, if, or staking out a claim to be the home of free trade, if we see a more protectionist policy in the US. I mean, is that sort of rhetoric going to last contact with reality, as they like to say?
You know, I think the thing is, it just so much depends on the level of aggression that we see as far as trade tariffs are concerned from Trump, because that can actually impact, you know, global growth. And so even if Europe sort of tries to separate itself and identify itself as the sort of the king of free trade, then if there's really weak global growth, does that make too much difference? Probably not. You know, we know that the European economy is in a bit of a difficult spot at the moment. So I guess, like, any sort of ways to be able to identify as a in a unique way is going to be useful. But I do think that if there is a global growth problem, then even Europe is going to suffer from that.
Yeah, and we talked about this yesterday, the kind of extraordinary pictures, and it's on the front of the Financial Times' homepage today again, of all those tech bosses at the inauguration: Mark Zuckerberg of Meta, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, of course Elon Musk, Sundar Pichai of Google there as well. And the FT got this story, Fiona, about the Trump administration potentially drawing up retaliatory tax measures for where they say countries are applying extraterritorial levies on US multinationals. We know Europe, for example, in particular, has been looking at ways to tax big tech more. Sounds like that's another kind of potential uncertainty chucked into that kind of global mix you were talking about.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, you know, these sort of reports that are coming out, these just really highlight and underscore how we are moving into a different period now, a different era. Obviously, we've had sort of a fair amount of uncertainty to do with central banks and raising interest rates and inflation. But I feel now with Trump, and he is sort of quite an unpredictable character. We know that sort of he does almost relish on that idea of being unpredictable in order to give him advantages in negotiations. But that creates this massive level of uncertainty. So we're seeing this sort of caution, as we talked about, in the markets being reflected right now as to, you know, what is going to come. Although it hasn't been perhaps as fierce as we expected on the first day, that doesn't mean that necessarily things will pave out in a rosy manner to go forward.
No, fascinating. Plenty more from Fiona throughout the programme, because a few more of these issues are ones, as Fiona says, that are going to affect all of us potentially one way or another. They've got sort of unforeseen knock-ons a lot of the times. Among those executive orders that President Trump signed overnight US time were around immigration as well. One in particular tackling the definition of birthright citizenship, another declaring illegal immigration at the border a national emergency. That's the border with Mexico. President Trump swiftly made moves on his promises to tighten that border up.
First, I will declare a national emergency at our southern border. All illegal entry will immediately be halted, and we will begin the process of returning millions and millions of criminal aliens back to the places from which they came.
Well, this topic was something which proved the number one priority amongst many of the president's keenest supporters, those who were out braving the freezing temperatures lining the streets of Washington to wave to his presidential motorcade yesterday. And they were stopped by the BBC's Justin Webb, who asked them about their priorities.
Julie Newport, St. Louis, Missouri.
I'm Tim Newport, St. Louis, Missouri.
When talking to people about, gosh, I can hardly speak, I'm so cold. There are executive orders this evening, mm-hmm. a load of them. What is it that you particularly want to see him concentrate on?
To be a country, you need borders. It's a crime to cross the border illegally.
And you want to see the border completely closed?
In the vein of people coming in without going through the process, yes.
There are two aspects to that, aren't there? There's the closing of the border, and the other thing that Donald Trump wants to do is to find people who are here illegally and send them home. Here's the thing, though. A lot of those people have been here a long time. They've had kids here. They're part of society here. Do you want to see them rounded up and sent home? What do you want the priorities?
Absolutely. They came here illegally.
I think it's important that we stop giving money, taxpayer money, to people that aren't citizens of this country. Mm-hmm. And if people are here and they're working, that's fine. But if you're here and you're just taking money for free, then right. You should go. I think if you want to work here, then you can stay here. That's my opinion.
My name is Mary Glynn. I'm from Rockaway, Queens, New York, and I'm here with my family. Absolutely. Close the border. Stop the illegal immigration. The second an illegal comes across the border, they're committing a crime. And there are many people who are ahead of the line, so to speak, trying to come into the country legally. We love legal immigrants. I'm the daughter of immigrants. My parents came here legally.
The views of Trump supporters on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., on Monday. Got big potential economic implications too, though. The Peterson Institute for International Economics think tank based in Washington, D.C., normally slightly right of center as well, estimating the U.S. economy could shrink 1.2% by 2028 if the government goes ahead and deports 1.3 million people, which it considers to be at the low end of the deportation goal. Meanwhile, the Pew Research Center, another U.S. think tank, said of the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States in 2022, 8.3 million were part of the workforce. So potential implications for companies, prices, all that kind of thing. But what does it feel like being a migrant in the United States right now? We got three Mexican Americans together to share their thoughts, and it's starting with Vianney Aldrete Contreras.
I was born in Mexico in Ciudad Juarez. My dad is a Mexican citizen and my mom is a U.S. citizen. I moved to the U.S. when I was 11 years old, and I am lucky enough that I am a naturalized U.S. citizen, and I was able to keep my Mexican citizenship, so I have dual citizenship.
My name is Ingrid Leyva. I grew up in Ciudad Juarez, and then I am now living here in El Paso. I have been always like having the opportunity to be in both parts of the border. I'm a local artist.
My name is Viridiana Villa, or Viri.
I was born in Mexico City, and I grew up in Ciudad Juarez all my childhood. Then I eventually migrated to the United States. I'm an instructor, so I teach graphic design and photography at Del Community College. I also work in marketing, and I'm a freelance photographer and graphic designer.
How do they feel about the new presidency?
I think it's giving me a little bit of trauma. It's literally making me speechless.
It feels uncertain. It's not promising as it used to be, you know? Especially because most of the House of Representatives and the Congress, it's a completely different story than last time. So it's a little bit more uncertain, especially for me, because I'm under the DACA program. Basically what it does is that it allows people who migrated when they were children to work in the U.S. legally, and they're also protected from deportation. So we don't get deported, and we are allowed to get a Social Security number and work and, you know, do the taxes and all that fun stuff without fear of deportation, but we don't have any pathway to actually get a citizenship. We're in this limbo, like it's a migratory limbo. That's the way people know it. So that program has always been attacked by the Republicans and defended by activists, but it's always a unstable way of living here.
For me, I share that feeling with you, Ingrid. I feel like I speak from a place of privilege because, again, I have dual citizenship. There's been some threat about getting rid of a naturalization process or being able to take someone's citizenship if they are not naturalized citizen. And even if I was to be completely okay if someone said, no, no one can take your citizenship, your U.S. citizenship away from you. I still cannot be at peace when my friends and strangers do not get a peace of mind.
Ingrid.
I feel very sad sometimes. Even if my situation is different, I feel like we share a lot of ground in terms of how much energy is required to just maintain a status, right? Like, I'm a student. My family, who are my mother and my two sisters, are U.S. citizens. And then they came to live here when I was living in Mexico City. And then I was wanting to come home to the border, and they were just here. So I enrolled in school immediately to start as well learning English. And I have been in an F1 status, which means a student status in the United States as an immigrant, for like about, 8 years. I have the opportunity to be in an immigration process to be able to acquire my residence right now. And it feels like nerve-wracking because, I mean, think about it, this is ridiculous that I will like have to be separated from my family just because maybe they don't want to give me the residency. I don't know.
What does the future look like for them?
I'm the only person without papers in the whole family. You know, I recently got a home, so now I got a mortgage to pay. But it's also a little bit exhausting how we always constantly try to prove ourselves, like we are exemplary citizens and that we work. That's my stance, a little bit fearless, a little bit positive, but I try not to let the fear consume me. I will cry and I will, you know, rant about it on social media, but I know I'm going to come through because, I don't know, that's how we are built.
Views of three Mexican Americans there. Well, let's get the views of Megan Benton, director of the International Program at the Migration Policy Institute. Megan, great to have you on World Business Report. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Was listening to Republican Representative Pete Sessions, member of Congress, on the BBC earlier this morning, Texas congressman. So you'd think of all the people he might have talked about and thought through this policy, he would have a decent position. It does sound like the headline is there, but not much of the detail about how any of this is going to work, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was no secret that President Trump wanted to make mass deportation a big feature of his second presidency. But I think we're now beginning to see, well, what the details mean. But there's a certain level of organization and planning in what was announced yesterday. It looks like a much more experienced presidency. And a lot of their new executive orders that were released yesterday evening are designed to kind of knit together this idea of mass deportation and work out how to make, well, detention first of all, and then deportation possible at a large scale. There are lots of question marks. I mean, I think one big one related to those people you had speaking just now is who will they prioritize? Mm. You know, there are lots and lots of different statuses, even in that, you know, group of people you had interviewed, mixed status families, people on different types of temporary status. Will they focus on those with criminal records, as, you know, President Obama did, for instance, or will they focus on more recent arrivals? You know, it's really unclear who will they prioritize. And that's what's creating this kind of climate of fear that will be so pervasive.
Yeah. And from a business and economics perspective as well, you know, we picked through some of the numbers there. That's why this seems difficult to calculate, right? Because people's status has changed over that period of time. We heard someone there, you know, who entered the country illegally, but has got a legal status through the Dreamers, you know, different things, wasn't the Dreamers program, the DACA program there. You know, what does that person count as now? And right now, they are an active member of the workforce.
Absolutely. There are lots of different types of legal status. I mean, one big program that the Biden administration introduced was Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans and Venezuelans could come in through legal routes if they had a sponsor. And many of them are now in work. So you will see quite a lot of impact on, you know, they might be in jobs. They might be even homeowners. They're people who are quite embedded in their communities. And so it could have quite a sizable impact.
And paying tax, of course, as well. And as a result, are companies having to respond and get their kind of, I don't know, have an idea, look into this, deploy people to look into this?
I'm sure that companies are responding. I mean, I think that no one wants to rush ahead with things before things have become more clear. I mean, I think it's also worth thinking about the broader economic impacts on the region. So if you do have mass deportations to Mexico, to Northern Central America, these are always countries that have received the bulk of deportees and have repatriation agreements with the United States, but they also rely really heavily on remittances, so money that people send back. I mean, there's a bit of evidence that deportees with their, you know, good English skills are able to get jobs in Mexican call centers, for instance, but any economic benefit will be massively dwarfed by a loss of remittances. And with what's quite poor reintegration support, concerns about implications in gangs, you know, you might see some security concerns as well interacting with those economic ones.
And I guess we're seeing massive differences from those sort of countries that may be returnees into the types of infrastructure they're putting in place, be it financial or physical. Looking at a quote here from the Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, for example, talking about cool heads. They sound like they're already planning, but that is going to vary wildly as well around the world.
It will. And one question I think is whether or not Mexico will accept back non-nationals, which it has in recent years. The Biden administration has done a lot to kind of build out regional cooperation, mostly through kind of carrots. It has its Legal Pathways program that I mentioned in return for Mexico taking back non-nationals of countries that can't be returned. But it also doesn't want to have a bunch of returnees. And I think one question will be how President Trump kind of plays his relationships in the region. I don't think it's a coincidence, for instance, that Mexico and Canada are being singled out for tariffs. There's talk about using denying visas to government officials, for instance. There's a lot of sort of mood music around using sticks rather than carrots to get better cooperation. But I don't know whether or not talking about the Panama Canal or Mexico being another state is going to play that well for the new president.
As you say, we know there's going to be an impact, the shape and the size of that impact. Difficult to tell until we know the actual details of the policy and we start seeing it in action, don't we? I'm sure we'll have it back on the programme at that point, Megan. Thanks, as always,
Thank
for your
you.
Time. Megan Benton there, the Director of the International Programme at the Migration Policy Institute. You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Let's step away from the United States for a moment now, because the cost of making phone calls, being online and sending messages is set to increase massively in Nigeria by as much as 50%. So why? Tony Izagbe Emokpere is the president of the Association of Telecommunications Companies of Nigeria and joins us live on the programme now. Tony, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Thank you.
This is a huge rise. Why is it needed?
Well, actually, it's been clamored for about 10 years now. The tariffs have remained static for over 10 years. And the cost of operating telecom services in Nigeria has drastically increased in the last several years, and most especially in the last 3 to 4 years, due to the rising cost of inflation and other operational challenges. So even the clamor was even for more than 50%. It was actually for a clamor for 100% increase.
Well, a clamor from your industry and your members, not from users, though, who were already struggling with that high inflation.
Yes, but the users have also been struggling with poor communication services due to underinvestment in the sector. So,
what guarantees are there that it will be reinvested? We hear this all around the world, don't we? Oh, yeah, we're going to hike your bills. And then actually the service is still poor and people are paying more for it and they've got no way out, no choices around it.
Actually, the operators are continuously investing in the sector. It's not like investment has actually decreased. But with this new increase, and this will be some of the guarantees I'm sure the regulators will extract from all operators to ensure that there shall be some form of investment in the sector. So we understand the clamor of consumers. And don't forget, if the consumers are not paying for the services, the operators are dead anyway. So,
well, I was going to say, do you not worry that potentially a lot of people will just go, you know what, that's actually a bill too far. I'm going to cancel my contract or downgrade it or not buy as much data.
Actually, Nigeria, despite the size of its population and all, is actually one of the lowest tariffs in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's not like it's a big leap, so to speak. We're already enjoying very, very low tariffs already. So the issue is not abandoning communication, but making it more sustainable, which is where everybody's going.
And what about bringing that communication to bits of the country that have struggled to get it so far? Is there still a commitment to that too?
Definitely, and hence the reason why this comes into play. Also, there is actually a fund called the USPF fund with the regulator, whereby a certain portion of revenues from the operators are set aside to develop services in the underserved and unserved areas. So if they are not making enough money to even support the urban areas, how would they have that cap to invest in other areas? So this is a step in the right direction for all concerned.
Tony, thanks a lot for your time. Tony Azagbe Emekpere there, the president of the Association of Telecommunications Companies of Nigeria. Let's return to the US. And as we were saying, the energy sector, one of those that's been rattled a bit today, in part because of President Trump talking like this.
And the next item, sir, is a letter that will be transmitted to the United Nations explaining that we are withdrawing from the Paris Climate Treaty.
Cheers as President Trump signed a withdrawal for the second time from the Paris Climate Treaty there. Fiona Sincotta still with us of City Index. Fiona, this had an impact, as you said already, on things like oil, but also Ørsted, one of the world's biggest manufacturers of wind turbines, Danish company. Its shares were down as much as 14% at one point today. Just glancing at the screen to my right now, still down 11% today.
Yes. So, this is, again, sort of reactions that we're seeing to do with sort of, Trump's anti-wind policy, less in favour of renewable energy sources. The shares plunged. They've put a 12.1 billion Danish crowns. So that's around 1.69 billion in impairment charges related to their US offshore market. So, this is a huge hit for Ørsted.
And it's another example of something that could have a huge impact. People listening thinking, oh gosh, they're going on about Trump again today. But this is the type of thing, if these companies start to struggle and their share prices fall like this, less investments going into them, they're less able then to employ people, build out more, launch new projects at a time where other countries who are still committed to the green transition and want more offshore wind, say, will struggle to be able to get the products at competitive prices.
Exactly. It's a really good point because obviously the US is the world's largest economy and, whatever happens there, it does impact the rest of the world and the ability of companies to be able to act competitively and to be able to bring, as you said, competitive prices to other countries as well. So the knock-on effect from aggressive policies from Trump can be and potentially could be very big as far as certain sectors are concerned, certain companies are concerned, but also global growth is concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're ones to keep watching if you want to kind of get a bit of a feel of how the politics is meeting with the economics and business. Keep an eye out for companies like that, car manufacturers, EV makers, people as well. Over the next few weeks, sure, we'll be talking about them loads on the programme as well. Fiona Sincotta there, Senior Market Analyst at City Index, looking through the financial markets for us from London. Big thanks to all of you for listening to World Business Report.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.